Welcome to the Books Cafe, your literature program on KBC English Service. I'm your host, Haing Okwemba. The Books Cafe is a cutting-edge program in the world of literature, where we talk to writers and explore contemporary literary issues.
Today's program was first aired on the Books Cafe on KBC English Service on June 17, 2017.
We are visited in our studio with Cap Akirok, for many years a columnist with the Standard newspapers and also with the Star newspaper. But I know him best as a writer of many books. I'll just mention one, Heartbeats of the Mind, the poetry collection. Cap Akirok has just published his latest book, Dusk in the Morning. Cap, welcome to the Books Cafe.
Thank you so much, Ndugu Kainga. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
When writers come on the Books Cafe, they always want to know when and where they were born, the things that actually shaped them at that very early age to become the writer that we enjoy reading. So let's begin from there. Where and when was Cap Akirok born?
Oh my. Okay. I was born in 1960, in a place called Sosio in Mount Elgon sub-county, that is in Bungoma County, next to Trans-Nzoia. Went to school, two primary schools. There was one called Chemoge Primary School, and then I finished in another one called Chemses, and from there I went to Kapsokwanch Secondary School, which is about 5 kilometers away from where I was born. And then from there I made my big move. I had never left home since I was born, and I decided then to go to a school called Nyeri High School, which was hundreds of kilometers away from home for my high school. Now, Nyeri, of course, was a completely new world for me. Met all sorts of people from all over the country, and it really opened my mind. From there, University of Nairobi, and then from there on, other places, including US and Europe and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, you actually say that after your elementary studies or your formative days in schools in Western, in Mount Elgon, you proceeded to Nyeri High School. And then you went to the university. Nairobi?
Yes.
What were you studying?
There's something I skipped, which I should have told you, even before I went to school. What I remember very distinctly is the lessons I got at home from my mother and my grandmother. What was very exciting for me was just waiting to listen to interesting stories told by my grandmother, especially, and later my mother. Those are very vivid in my memory. I remember looking forward every time to evening time, and they would tell me these stories until I fall asleep. So I remember that distinctly.
I want us to stay there just a little bit, that you are born in Mount Elgon.
Yes.
Professor Chris has always described that mountain as very beautiful.
Chris Wanjala.
The famous Professor Chris Wanjala.
Wanjala.
If you could just describe for us, you know, there's that mountain, because many people talk of Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya.
I'll tell you something about Mount Elgon that a lot of people do not know. First of all, I like saying that I was born in the armpit of Mount Elgon. That is on the slopes of Mount Elgon. I prefer the word armpit. There are two distinct things. One is that it's the only mountain in the world with cave elephants. You know, it's got several caves, and elephants go into those caves to lick salt. You know, what we studied in school called stalactites, stalagmites.
Mm-hmm.
So they go in there to lick salt, and they actually live inside the caves.
Yeah.
It's the only mountain in the entire world where you have cave elephants. Number two.
Amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Come to think of it, Mount Elgon is also the only mountain in the entire world that has the largest footprint, what we call a footprint. You see, Mount Kilimanjaro, by contrast, is considered a mountain with the smallest footprint. The footprint is the entire base of the mountain before it rises up. So Mount Elgon's base, that's what I'm calling the foot, is very broad and very wide. It's the widest in the world. So it may not be very high, but it's very broad. And of course, I grew up there in Mount Elgon. And what I remember distinctly is our home was what I call an armpit, where if you look up, you see the height of the mountain in its glory. But when you look down, you see the escarpment and the expansive plain below, which spreads across below all the way to Webuye, and on a clear day you could see as far as the Nandi Hills, and at night you could see flashes of lightning from Lake Victoria.
Mm-hmm. Where you are born.
No, not standing on the mountain, where our home was. Very, very strategically placed. So I always grew up looking up in the mountain and then looking down in the valley. So very interesting. Depending on the direction I turn, I either look at a beautiful expansive plain below, or I look up and see the beautiful mountain.
This glorious Mount Elgon.
Yes. So, and I like looking at it as, you know, basically growing up in the armpit of Mount Elgon.
In the armpit of Mount Elgon. Mm. You know, you actually make some very interesting revelation there, but that it is the only mountain in the world that has cave elephants.
Right.
The cave elephants, how different are they from this big elephant?
The normal African elephant?
Yes.
No, it's not different. It's not a different species at all.
Mm.
The caves are big. Don't have the idea that we're talking about small caves here. The caves that the elephants go to are huge, enormous caves. So yes, they are just a normal African elephant, really.
Great. And then you say that they go there to actually look for salt.
They go there to lick salt from the wall of the cave and then stay there overnight, and they come out. You know, so it is a very interesting thing that I think that the Minister of Tourism should really exploit it and use it to really advertise it, because it's very distinctive.
You know, actually talking about the Ministry of Tourism, what kind of preservation has actually the government offered to this unique, glorious Mount Elgon?
Yes, they have the Mount Elgon National Park, which is gazetted. So the mountain is part of the park, which is officially gazetted by the government. So that offers some measure of protection. But beyond that, you need to develop proper roads. You need to market the place. You need people to know. You can have some nice, bright, shining lamp, but if you cover it in a bowl, nobody will see it. So it's important that it is advertised adequately and properly so that more people get to know it, and then we have more visitors going there. And then they need to do proper routes into the mountain.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, born in the 1960s as a young boy, what was the environment like that you grew in that time? The things that you did, apart from listening to folk stories and heroic stories from your grandmother.
I'll tell you what, I come from a community that almost worships livestock, or used to be that way. The young people don't care too much about livestock now. But during my time, livestock was extremely important. And in fact, there is a book, a children's book that I wrote called I Blame the Sky, which I was surprised that it won the Jomo Kenyatta Prize for Literature in 2013. It's a little book called I Blame the Sky, and it all revolves around an old man, herders, and livestock. So my early life was surrounded by that. I would get up in the morning, of course, have breakfast, milk, and then take the cattle out in the pasture and then bring them back in the evening. So you have plenty of time to dream, to daydream, as you are out there looking after cattle. An incredible feeling. So one of the things that sort of ignited and fired up my imagination as I was looking after cattle was reading literature. I would read anything that I come across, including remnants of newspaper that has been used to wrap meat. Once you're done with the meat and you throw away the paper, I would go look for that paper and actually read the text. The blood-stained newspaper, I would read that. So I would read a lot. I remember just looking at atlases, you know. Atlases really fascinated me, because then I could see the world. Many of those atlases were illustrated. If it was the map of Alaska, you would have illustrations of, say, Eskimos and so on, and seals and walruses and so on and so on. And really, really, really that fired my imagination. So that developed into a serious reading culture. So whenever I got a book, I would go with that book to pasture, look after cattle as I read. And it got me into a lot of trouble because I would be so engrossed reading that when I look up, I find the cattle have got lost. Where have they gone? Where have the cattle gone? And in fact, that story that I just told you, I Blame the Sky, is exactly around my childhood, you know, what I was going through. Some herders that actually lost cattle. So the cattle would be lost and I would be running around and say, where have they gone? Where have they gone? Then, of course, I would get into trouble and I would be whipped because perhaps the cattle went into someone's farm, strayed into someone's property, and I'd really be disciplined. And I remember my dad getting so exasperated with me and saying, "Kwani utakula hii kitabu? Are you going to eat the book? Yeah, you're reading so much." And it's very ironic because I can say he was still alive. He passed on. Right. And I've said, "Dad, yes, actually eat this book." Because you can't make a living from writing unless you're very lucky. But what it did was helped me
to broaden your scope of thinking in the world around you.
Absolutely. It gave me the opportunity to adventure and to pursue my imagination. I wrote my first storybook when I was in Form 2. I was 15 years old when I wrote my first little story. I remember I wrote it in this 120-page exercise book.
Yes, yes.
So I just wrote. And inevitably it was about a little girl that excited my imagination. I was just coming of age. I spent some time writing about her. And I actually wrote 120 pages of an exercise book by hand. I still have it somewhere in the house. I'm terrified to read it now. I don't want to even dare open and read it because I think I would laugh myself to death.
No, but it happens. You know, you remind me of the famous Egyptian poet Zain El Abidine. I met him some years back in Cairo.
Right.
And he told me that he started writing poetry when he was very young, almost the same age, or a little younger. What happened was that he came across a newspaper where the editor was asking for some poetry, and the editor had actually left the address.
Right.
So he wrote, you know, that time you are not politically conscious, like in poetry, just, you know, you are interested in creating rhymes and that kind of thing, just being expressional. So he wrote, and 1 month later he was surprised to actually see this poetry published in the newspaper. So he continued writing.
Wow.
Because of his rhyming, they continued to publish him, not knowing that the guy who was writing this poetry was just a small boy.
Look
so
at that.
So many years later, he actually met the editor. And he said that it was me, Zain El Abidine. I said, come on, you could write those poems at that age, the concentration. So it happened. Kap Kirok there, starting to write as a young boy in high school. You say that you grew up in Mount Elgon.
Yes.
And the community there, people who almost worshipped livestock and storytelling. Which people are you talking
about? These are the koin, sometimes called the sabaot. The koin or the sabaot are small sub-tribe of the Kalenjin, the wider Kalenjin group. Many actually think it is the dispersal point of the Kalenjin. Other Kalenjin groups consider it the origin.
Their Krado.
Yes, the Krado, basically. I guess one of our famous coin people in athletics would be somebody called Ben Chipcho. You may have heard of Ben Chipcho. Late 60s, early 70s. He was the guy that held the world 3,000 steeplechase record for 10 years.
In the 1960s?
From 68 to 1978. So I would say perhaps he's one of our more famous, well-known.
There's this famous documentary filmmaker and veteran journalist, Sir Mohinder Dhillon. He actually did a documentary on those early African runners. I'll check it out. He must be one of those.
Benjamin Chipcho, a contemporary of Keino.
And then you go to high school in Nyeri, and then from there you go to the University of Nairobi. What did you study at the university?
Before I left, while I was in Nyeri, I was doing chemistry, biology, and mathematics. But all the time, my mind and my heart was in literature. I will also tell you that before I tell you about university, in secondary school, before high school, my heart was in literature, but my father said, "You have to do science because that's where you'll get your daily bread. Forget about this other stuff like music, literature, and so on." So I focused on science reluctantly. I did, you know, decently well in secondary school to go to high school, did biology, chemistry, and so on. But all the while, my heart was really not there.
It was always in literature.
Yes, my heart was always in literature. And so at the University of Nairobi, I did chemistry and biology, and then went deeper into biology in the second, third year, and so came up with a Bachelor of Science degree. But as soon as I got the earliest opportunity to move away from science, I moved out into business administration, MBA in business administration, and so on. drifted slightly away from, clearly from science, to the liberal arts and so on. And so that's basically what I studied at the university. While at the university, I was very keen, as I said, literature, reading a lot of stuff on literature and so on. I remember reading War and Peace by Tolstoy.
Leo Tolstoy.
Yes, from a very early age. And people used to look at me and say, are you out of your mind? I mean, this is a huge book of 1,000 pages. Are you going to finish that? But I was very fascinated by that. And I would bury myself into it. So I was into this from a very early age. And then every time I traveled, I would scribble my thoughts somewhere in a diary. I would just scribble them and so on and so on. And years later, I showed them to a publisher and said, does this make sense? And this was actually Jimmy Makosi.
Jimmy Makosi is also a playwright.
Yeah, so Jimmy, I looked at them and said, Cap, we call these ones poems. I said, oh, really? And so we just put a collection together, some of them dating as far back as when I was in secondary school, some high school. I thought they were silly reflections, but he persuaded me to have them published. So that's when I published them in Heartbeats of the Mind. And then...
What a coincidence. You know, Cap, our guest today on the Books Cafe, I met him when he was launching one of his many books, and he gifted me with this collection of poetry, Heartbeats of the Mind. Yeah. And today in the morning, when I was coming in the studio, I just picked on this book. I said that Cap, he's actually written a wonderful novel, but I know him as a poet. I'm going to carry this poetry book so that he can actually just pick one and read randomly.
2 years later, he also persuaded me, after this one came out, to say, do you have another collection of reflections? I said, yes, I do, because that time I was working for Kenya Airways, and I used to travel quite a lot. And as usual, I would observe, write, reflect on what I see, what I think, what I feel. And so that was put again into another fresh collection. It was called Loud Monologues, Silent Dialogues, which again was also published in 2004, I believe. Right now I have another collection that I hope to publish.
Poetry?
Yes, I have what I hope is a mature collection, mature poetry collection. Because a lot of my earlier reflections were, as I said, from going as far back as when I was in secondary school. These ones are more philosophical, more reflective, the fresh ones that I'm going to publish. Yeah, unlike the earlier ones, yeah.
Great day if you are just tuning in. This is the Books Cafe on KBC English Service, and our guest is the award-winning Kenyan writer Cap Akirok, who has just published his latest novel, Dusk in the Morning. I'm your host, Kainga Okwemba. But before we start delving into this book, I would actually invite Cap to read from his early writing, that collection of poetry, Heartbeat of the Mind, that he's just spoken about. Randomly pick a poem there, Cap, and read.
Okay. All right, let me pick this one. The title is Nature. Have you ever walked in the woods and listened to the woodpecker seminar as they drill and prepare their roosts and not felt the ego in your chest? What about the merry chuckle of the eucalyptus leaves as they enjoy the wind's tickle? Has it not provoked in you a giggle? And have you ever sat by a perpetual stream and beheld the silent flow of water over papers, tame and trim, and noticed the ebb and flow of time? If so, you have partaken of nature's gifts, as true and pure and free as can be. And if you need a cure for your usual tips, remember, nature overflows with free frills. That's just a random one that I picked. Let me read a sad one for a change. This was about my boss when she passed on.
The title of the poem?
It's called Rao, an Ode to Eternity. At a time like this, life seems like a piece of luck. And yet we are told God does not play dice. And so death, it appears, is preordained to appear at its own appointed time. But surely, is this way of fate not a little rude? There's something mysterious about the word forever. Its echoes tear through the frail bones of the universe into a place known only to the grand designer, leaving behind sadness hard to fathom. But consider the depth of our dignity. Is forever not conquerable? Happy is the whore whose praises the crops sing, so says a proverb of the coin of Mount Elgon. And so the whore will break eventually, but the crops it helps to nurture continue to bloom and fruit. Isn't that heartwarming? To say Rao was a pillar of strength and courage is to state the obvious and even appear frivolous. And so I'll speak of a spirit, a flaming spirit, a spirit that radiated supreme self-belief, a spirit that said calmly but firmly, if it can be done, it'll be done. Goodbye, Rao. It can be done. It has been done.
It's an elegy for a colleague that has passed on.
And then a quick one here. I had visited Dubai for the first time.
Yes.
And I was amazed, as most people are. And so it's just very small reflection here. It says Dubai at night. And it was at night when I saw this. Ghostly reeds of fire shiver in the water recess, swaying in the soft breeze like a drunken dream. Rapper on concrete, drum and hum, hum and drum. Swish and whoosh, whoosh and swish, like a lady's dress. Street lights on lampposts gaze like dazed mantis. Brick, mortar and glass jostle for the meaning of close. The city is aglow with a tumble and a clash of egos. And I wash with wines and spirits of endless parties. It was just reflection.
Kap Akirok there, the author of Her Dusk in the Morning. The book, it's a work of prose, but it's actually flavored with poetry. He's going to read some of the poems that are in this book, Dusk in the Morning. It's a story about this young lady called Grace Dikedi Goit Esemang. She's supposed to be the daughter of a lady from Botswana. They live in a country called the Republic of Koni.
Yes.
And her mother was taken from Botswana to come and work for a diplomat in the Republic of Koni. And she has a sister, a twin sister, called Dipuo. The story itself is actually set in a convent.
Yes.
At the beginning of the story, we see this young girl who is just preparing to celebrate her 22nd birthday. And then something happens strangely in her biological understanding of nature. She starts to worry, what is happening to my body? Let's take it from there. Are you a Catholic?
I am very Catholic. I grew up in a Catholic family. My mother was deeply Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I love my Pope very much. The current Pope is brilliant. I think he's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He's a man of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And he is committed to the way of Christ,
mm-hmm.
and which is really great.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean it. I really love my Pope. Yes, you're right. This is a story about a lady. There are really two girls, twins. Mm-hmm. And they're not just twins. They are what we call mirror image twins.
Yes.
You know, there are two types of twins.
Yes, yes.
The ordinary twins and mirror image twins.
Yes.
So these two are mirror image twins.
Yes.
Now, just for context, mirror image twins, you cannot tell, 99.9% of the population cannot tell them apart if they are dressed the same way. That's that. But their mother came to this Republic of Koin, somewhere on earth.
But in Africa.
Their mother came from Botswana.
Yes.
And she accompanied a diplomatic couple that were posted to the Republic of Koin.
Yes.
And so she was a house help. So after the diplomats had finished their tour of duty and
They went back,
this girl decided to stay. She had come to like
the Republic of Koin,
particularly the city of Cool Rivers in the Republic of Koin. And she decided, I don't want to go back home. To cut a long story short, she had twins, and one of the twins decides to go to the convent.
To become a nun.
Yeah, to pursue the path of becoming a nun. Her twin sister decides no. She got a job at a hair salon, a beauty spa. And so the lady in the convent is called Diketi Kotsemang, and the sister is called Dipuo. Mm-hmm. And she's committed to becoming a nun, and there are stages that you go through, obviously, and you'll find them in the book. And she had just passed a very solid stage.
She had actually taken her first vow.
First vows, and she was only left with the final vows. So, very excited. Then suddenly she discovers, what is going on? I've missed my menses, I've missed my periods. And then she's in real panic. So the first question you ask yourself is that, how can a sister in a convent even entertain the thought of being pregnant? But the challenge is this. This whole story was inspired by conversations that I had with ex-nuns. One of them had been in the convent for 11 years. Another one had been there for 17, and they left.
Mm-hmm.
For different reasons. And I just got curious to understand their lives, really, their life in the convent. And for the most part, it's wonderful. But I think that we all know that life is not wonderful all the time. Life is not perfect. Life is not 100 out of 100. And it is the 1% or the 2% or the 5% that is often interesting. And so it is useful to explore that small percentage and look at it and say, did we know about this? And so I thought, you have a choice of either just going through life sedately and just assume everything is okay, or you bring to light from the shadows some of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not predominantly, but occasionally,
mm-hmm.
or even rarely, but they still do happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that they deserve to come out into the light, and then people confront it and hopefully make them reflect and think deeply, mm-hmm. about certain fundamental issues. And I know later on you'll ask me some of the themes running through the book, and I will share, I think, two major lessons that I think come out of the book. Mm-hmm. Others could find more lessons.
Yes, yes.
But the obvious ones, I have two that I can see, obviously, which I can talk about later on.
You're right. Yeah. Now, you know, the story of this young girl, you know, she's not a young girl, actually a young lady called Edikedi. She's actually taken her first vows and she's on the path of becoming a full nun.
Right.
And then she discovers on her 22nd birthday that she's pregnant. Okay? A lot of research there. As a writer yourself, even getting into the mind of this young girl, first, how does she tell that she is pregnant? She's not an ordinary person who can just walk into a hospital and say that, Daktari, I want you to check if I'm pregnant. So that is one of the conflicts in the story, and you address it very well. She has her twin sister, and between them they agree, I didn't know. I want you to educate us, because you must have sat with some gynecologist that you can actually do the pregnancy test at home on your own.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, the challenge that arose was what do I do now? How do I confirm this? How do I tell whether I simply skipped my period and I'm okay, or this really means that I'm actually pregnant? So how do you find that out as a nun? And there are rules in the convent. When you go out, you should always be dressed. It depends on the order, but this particular order was strict. When you go out, you must always be dressed in a nun's habit. It's called habit, the dress that they put on. So you can't walk through and say, I need that. So she had to figure out a way of getting the test kit. And those are available now.
Mm-hmm.
Those are widely available. You can get a test kit. You get a test kit,
mm-hmm.
a self-testing kit.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and you go and test it in your own privacy.
Uh-huh.
Yes, absolutely. You buy it from a pharmacy and you simply go and test it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are now available. Any young lady can do that. So challenge was, how do you purchase it without being discovered as a nun, and why do you need it? I don't want to say everything that is in the book, because people must go and read, but just to hint, she overcame that challenge and ended up with a kid and performed the test
4 times.
Yes, to reconfirm and confirm and confirm, and guess what? She couldn't escape the fact that it is true, she had gotten pregnant. So the big question then is, how did she get pregnant? Who made her pregnant? And so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole story now goes into what really happens and the challenges of, do you stay there until you're discovered? Do you want to perform an abortion? And the conflict that you have in terms of your faith and also other
considerations, yes. Family issues and all that. But, you know, very interesting there that this girl, she discovers that she's pregnant, and she overcomes that. She actually goes through the motion. As a writer, as a social commentator, as a Catholic, looking at the situation now, because first, when you get into the convent, you are not allowed to go out if you are not in pairs.
Right.
Okay, when you're outside of the convent, you must always walk in pairs. I remember when I was in high school, there were schools, girls' schools, mm-hmm. that were very strict. So we would actually have a girls' school going out, like, for mm-hmm. example, like the ones that I would see in our school at Msingo High School those days.
Right.
Girls would always be walking in fours.
Yes.
You know, it has its meaning and significance, isn't it?
Yes. So first of all, yeah. what needs to be understood is that in the Catholic Church, there are very many orders.
Mm-hmm.
And each order, its strictness varies depending on the order.
Mm-hmm.
And also it depends also on the stage that you are, mm-hmm. on your journey towards becoming a full nun.
Mm-hmm.
If you are what they call a novitiate,
mm-hmm.
then yes, you must always be in pairs, you must always be in uniform and so on.
Mm-hmm.
When you pass that stage and you're now sort of like, you've taken your first vows,
mm-hmm.
and you're left with one more step to become a full nun,
mm-hmm.
some orders allow you to go out individually.
Yeah, like in this case, they were given 1 day in a week.
Absolutely.
So actually, that is where my question was,
yes,
coming in.
Yes.
You know, you are going to teach me how to pray the mysteries.
Take it that that's a very important auxiliary that is used in church. It's a very important instrument.
Mm.
It's a very important tool. that guides prayer and so on in a structured way.
Yes, yes.
And it is very powerful. It is very powerful. I have it in my car.
Kap Akirok, the writer who has actually written this wonderful novel, A Dusk in the Morning, that is set in a Catholic convent. And discussing, you know, the prayers, praying around the rosary and the mysteries. Of course, he's listed them in the book. We have the joyful mystery. We have the luminous mystery. We have the sorrowful and we have the glorious mysteries that sometimes when you are facing challenges in life, you just hold your rosary and you pray. And
if bit by bit.
So the question was that don't you think then this girl, that allowance, of course you've put it very well, that there are certain orders that are not very strict. For me, I was like, once you are in a convent, you should not be allowed to go out. So that you are not exposed to some of these temptations?
Not at all. Not at all. So it takes very little research to find that there is great variety in the level of freedom, if I may use that term, that is allowed.
Great. So are you going to read? We've actually just talked about Dikedi. She discovers that she's actually pregnant.
Yeah.
And she goes through the motion. She takes that test 4 times, not just one.
Yes.
To confirm and reconfirm.
Right.
We are at the point where she goes to confront the gentleman who is actually made her pregnant. And the way you paint the atmosphere, the tension, I just loved it. I want you to read from that part. Was it the one on page 53?
Yes. Now, this is this young lady, Sister Grace Dikedi. She is now going to see Bishop Dr. Masala Sala. And so the secretary ushers her in to his office, and then he says, "Hey, look who is here, Sister Grace. How are you, sister?" He beams and points to a chair next to a coffee table as Matilda closes the door behind her. Dikedi immediately notices some changes in the office since she was there last. The coffee table and the 2 chairs on either side are new. The usually open entrance to the adjoining room that serves as a private library beyond the bishop's desk now has a door. "I hear you have a letter for me," he says, as he shovels some papers on his desk. He seems to be avoiding eye contact. Or is he? This is, you know, her imagination, she thinks. Is he trying to avoid me or what? She fixes her eyes on him and does not respond for a few seconds to force him to look up, but he doesn't. He continues shoveling papers. He realizes she will not answer if he doesn't look up. She's annoyed that he asks her how she is and does not wait for her reply. She continues to stare at him in silence. After several seconds, he finally looks at her and asks, "Are you okay? You are so quiet today. Do you have a letter for me?" "Hi, Dr. Masala Sala. I'm okay, I guess." Dikedi stretches out her hand and forces him to shake. His grip is unusually tentative, although warm as usual. She responds to his soft grip with a slightly harder squeeze, which seems to prompt him to get up and walk around his massive half-moon mahogany desk. She hands him the letter. He beckons her to sit as he takes his seat next to the coffee table. He opens the letter and adjusts his spectacles to read. "I see. I didn't know you have an interest in writing poetry. Are you serious about this?" "Yes and no," she says. "Yes and no. Interesting. Tell me about the no part first." He still barely looks at her. The eye contact is fleeting. He has no idea what is coming. "I'll tell you the yes part first." He looks up at her. She sees surprise and mild amusement on his face. Her firm and declarative voice has got his attention. "Okay, as you like," he says with a look and tone that suggests mild annoyance and impatience. This ticks her off. "Okay, I'm happy to fulfill your wish. I'll start with the no part. No, I'm not really serious about writing poetry. My primary interest in getting that letter written to you is for me to have a face-to-face opportunity to tell you something. And yes, I'm serious in the sense that I do not mind learning poetry from you." He now looks at her strangely. She sees a mixture of bafflement and rising alarm. "No need to prolong this," she decides. "I'm pregnant." His jaw drops. In that split second, she thinks how the sad, shocked open mouth and the blank stare captured all the absurdities of life, of deflated spirits, helpless hope, of perished prayers and crashed castles, of milk spilled into dry, thirsty sands of time. He recovers quickly. His mouth closes, his forehead furrows in the front. The eyes are narrowed and peer at her, unblinking, and above the rim of his eyeglasses. He looks like a cornered wild animal. She's afraid he will bounce on her any minute. "You are what?" She had the question, not as a surprise or a shock, but as an accusation. What she had was, "How could you get pregnant?" She's boiling inside and feels like exploding, but she decides to be calm. After the incident in this office, I missed my period. I decided to carry out a pregnancy test. I tested 4 times and the results were the same. I am pregnant with your baby. She adds the last 3 words deliberately to make it sink into his thick head. It cannot be true. How do you know that you are? No, no, no. It cannot be true. How? How is it possible? The wild look is now that of a caged animal, desperately looking for an escape route which does not exist. The questions are no longer accusatory. They are a plea. She doesn't answer. She looks at him in silence. He looks left, down, up in the ceiling, everywhere except at her. Finally, he removes his eyeglasses and wipes them on his shirt and the middle of his stomach. He uses the open palm of his left hand to wipe his face. She finds both actions funny and she almost chuckles. He gets up, goes back to his desk and sits down for a second and so that she stands up again. He looks at his watch and walks towards the door to the secretary's office. At that instant, the secretary cracks the door and says, "I'm off for lunch." "Oh yes, of course, I had forgotten it's lunchtime," he says, forcing a smile. "Do you want a snack for both of you?" The secretary asks. "I'm okay," she quickly says this before he has a chance to say anything. He quickly takes the hint and says, "In that case, I'll skip my usual snack today." He now comes to sit opposite her across the coffee table. She's thinking, it's a good thing that the chair has armrests. The way he's slumped, he could topple over. Looking at him slumped in the chair, elbows on the armrest, chin on the right hand, which in turn is covering his left hand in a clenched fist, she feels a shadow of pity. His round, smooth, chubby face usually looks pretty, especially in those bifocal eyeglasses and white clerical collar. The person in front of her looks much older than his 40 years. Even his black command, the cassock, appears to make him look chappier. Dr. Masalasala is certainly a synonym for misery. "I know this is a shock. It was and still a shock to me too," she says. He says nothing. He gets up abruptly and disappears through the back door. At first, she's alarmed, but then guesses that he's going to the gents. There is a restroom in that direction. A few minutes later, he returns, but instead of coming to sit at the coffee table, he goes to sit behind his big desk. He starts fiddling with the papers on his desk again. I'll stop there.
Yes, yes. Interesting there. Actually, now, this is, of course, as we've alluded to the story, it's actually set in a convent, and this is a sister who is actually training to become a full nun. She discovers on her 22nd birthday that she's pregnant, and it so happens that the father of that unborn child is the bishop of the diocese. And again, it was very difficult to go and see the bishop. I've skipped that bit so that you can look for this wonderful book and see how, again, Cap Akirok, a master himself with his pen, he creates that conflict and the difficulty and the way, as a writer, he actually overcomes it. He brings them together. It's not that easy, always. You know, you cannot just wake up one day and say that I'm going to see a bishop and you are a nun, a student. It doesn't happen. Mm. So there has to be a way. It's very well articulated. Of course, the challenges and the difficulties, the way she tries to crack it out. How does this happen? The hurdles and the way she overcomes those hurdles. And she meets the bishop and she breaks this news. And you can see the atmosphere changing when she breaks that news. Dusk in the Morning. It's a very interesting book. It has many lessons, beautiful lessons, like I was talking about the prayers around right. the rosary, and even the processes of becoming a Catholic nun. But because we are human beings, there are all these challenges. For me, I would describe this as a beautiful but very controversial book.
I would agree with you. There are two lessons, first of all, that I see in the book. One, the simple reading of the book gives you the lesson around once you decide to become one thing, stick with it. Don't try to have your cake and eat it at the same time. Be what you've decided to be. Mm-hmm. So you can take that lesson and say Digeti should have stuck by what she wants to become, mm-hmm. as well as the bishop also to stick by what he has sworn to be and remain at that. When you break that vow, you're into trouble. So you can take a positive lesson from there and say, it's important if you see what happens to you if you do this. Number two, and a much more deeper level, is the long-running discussion around how do you pass on your consciousness to generations, the next generations and generations after that. Do you do it directly as an individual through your children, or do you do it indirectly through humanity as a collective? Mm-hmm. In other words, you can still pass your consciousness because life, I look at life as consciousness, human life as consciousness. We are conscious in a special way of ourselves and of the environment. And the purpose, we're always here to try to pass that. And you can pass it through your children directly and therefore have children. Hence the debate in the church that says, should priests be allowed to marry, just like in the Protestant faith? That debate is going on, and it's been going on in the Catholic Church for a long time.
Yes, celibacy.
Yes, celibacy. Should they be allowed to actually have children? Because there is that deep inner urge to pass on something. So the question is, do you pass it on directly through your children, or you can pass it on through serving humanity as a whole,
mm-hmm.
yeah, in your own way? And so that is the question that is there. And some of it is captured by the painful reflections of the bishop at the end through a letter that he wrote, which he calls an epistle to the Lord.
Yes, yes.
You want me to read that?
We shall actually conclude with that.
Okay.
Some other persons would actually look at this story, a powerful story, right. Yes, but also as an indictment. You know, we have heard all these cases about some priests who are pedophiles, and even now this one set in a Catholic convent, and we have this lady, young lady, who is actually trying to become a Catholic nun. Don't you think that she was vulnerable in the face of the bishop, and the indictment actually is on the powerful abusing their positions?
That is the debate that even the two sisters have in the book, Diketty and Dipuo. But if you read deeper, you find that there was also some hunger in the heart of this lady. And that part of that hunger was provided by this man. So there is an element of love that evolved. So it wasn't quite the power for using their position against a vulnerable, helpless girl. It wasn't that. But you're right. In the church, we've read in the news that there are those that use their positions and abuse their positions and commit crimes against young boys and girls. This is not a secret. It's been open. It's out there in the press and so on. And by the way, you just need to do very little research, Google, and you'll find that it's not unheard of to have nuns getting pregnant. It's happened. It happened some time back in the UK, where a nun actually gets pregnant and then she leaves the convent. So there are things that are happening that should not be happening, but they should not be buried. Eh? We would be doing a disservice to the church if we bury it and pretend that they are not happening and that we cannot talk about them. I believe that by discussing them, however uncomfortable they are, that it can, in the long run, make the church stronger. Yeah, confront them, deal with them. And our current Bob is actually dealing with it. He has apologized. He's come and apologized to the victims of molestation by bishops over various decades and has come out and say, we really apologize on behalf of the church. And that's the right spirit. Talk about it. Don't bury it. Don't cover it. Let's have a frank discussion about these issues and confront them, as taboo as they may appear.
Interesting. You know, I would actually invite the listeners of the Books Cafe to look for this interesting book at dusk in the morning. But what I would say is that Dikedi's twin sister, Dipuo, for me, she's an amazing, amazing character. She's my favorite character in that book.
Very practical. No nonsense.
Can you say something about this character?
She's cynical and she's, she looks at life practically and not idealistic, not dreamy, but looks at reality as it is and deals with it head on that way. And she's the more streetwise, if you like, of the two. And so it's interesting.
I would really want listeners to actually go and read this book and even just look for those sections, the many parts of the book where we have this character, Dipuo, appearing. She's an interesting person. Do you think the sister would have survived without her presence?
I doubt it. I think it would have been very difficult. She's very dependent.
She's a very strong pillar.
Yes, as practical suggestions from her sister.
Especially after the death of their mother.
Yes, after the death of her mother.
Mm.
And she, in a way, that's another lesson that you can learn from the book, that there is great value in being part of the hard life out there. A life in the convent is closeted, it's a little bit secluded, and so on, although occasionally they come out to serve people outside the convent, obviously, but they're not steeped into the reality of daily living out there. And so you can see that each has its value in its own way. So I doubt whether she would probably have made it on our own without her sister. So mm-hmm.
Earlier on, you actually did say that you did some research. You spoke to some two sisters, ex-nuns, who were part of the research that you did. Now, writing this story, how long did it take you?
It took me, because I'm a very busy person also, I have a full-time job. So this took me 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took a whole year for it to go through the publishing process from the time it was accepted. Took a year. That tells you something about our publishing industry also. And mine is among the ones that took the fastest route to publishing. They tell me, Longhorn Publishers have clearly told me that I was lucky. Many others take 2-3 years before they can come out, or even 5. But it's good. Now we have online publishing and so on, and hopefully more people can publish online rather than depend on the traditional publishing, which can take a long time. Because they also have to look at the prospects for the book. Is this book likely to sell and give us a return on our investment? And that's why they tend to focus mainly on textbook publishing, because they can sell those directly to schools.
You're right. Now, after you did your research and then you decided that you're going to write this novel, Dusk in the Morning, the characterization, you are not going to recreate, you know, recreating in the true sense of the word, the story of these two nuns that you had spoken to. Then how did you come up with the creating the characters that you create? These two sisters who are twin sisters. Of course, you have this landlord who is very stubborn, and then you have the bishop there, and then you have the convent environment. You know, just characterization. You've done your research. You want to write a book, but a story is told through characters.
It's told through characters, yes. You see, the whole structure of the plot is, at least that's my way of writing, seeks to answer the central question of the story. And so you ask yourself, how is this lady who is in a convent going to pull this off? She has her own motivations. She has certain goals she wants to achieve. But then there are certain challenges that prevent her from achieving those goals. What are some of the ways she can overcome those challenges so that she can still achieve her objectives? Maybe not fully, but largely. That's at the heart of the story, of storytelling. It is someone, a character, setting out to achieve a particular objective, but then there are obstacles to achieving that objective. So how do you overcome those obstacles? And for me, the whole architecture of characterization is structured in such a way that it tries to answer then the central question or the central objective of the book. And so in this particular case, having twin characters was a very useful tool in trying to overcome that challenge. For example, the problem now she has is that she's pregnant, but she doesn't want to terminate the pregnancy. And she still doesn't want to leave the convent. She cannot face life out there, at least at that moment, initially. That was her thought. But how does she go about this? Credibly, if you have a sister, a twin sister, is a mirror image, you can then entertain the idea of, can we pull a trick here where you can play my part? I hide this pregnancy as long as possible, and then
you see how it pans out.
Yes, and see how we can work it out. And that works out better when you have a twin sister. Now, then if this character, their mother was a house help, clearly her surroundings and her where she grew up, I mean, where she's lived and so on and so on, have to be credible, her circumstances. It's unlikely that she would just be living in great places and so on and so on. So there's a struggle that she also has to go through. So it's a detailed process of creating and characterizing. And what I do normally is on a whiteboard, an erasable whiteboard, I keep mapping the characters, and each one of them I'm asking myself, what is the objective? What does this one want to achieve? What are the obstacles? What does this one want to achieve? What are the obstacles? So you have on one column all the characters, on another column all the characters and their objectives and the potential obstacles towards achieving their objectives. And as you develop the story, new characters emerge that you didn't even think about.
You're right.
They pop up and so on. And each one of them also have their own goals and objectives, and they have obstacles to achieving those objectives. So that's basically how it's.
I'd actually ask you one last question, and then you'd read two poems, one from the middle of the book, and then the last one,
right,
the epilogue. Now, you've actually stated very well how, after doing your research, how you created these twin sisters. You know, the main character there, the protagonist, being Dikedi.
Yes.
The bishop. Is it the story of a person, of a real person in life that you fictionalized? Did you recreate the story of a bishop who is actually committed this crime?
No. I have to say very clearly that I exercised my discretion
as a
creative license.
As a writer.
What you do as a writer is, of course, you hold a mirror to society. When the people read it, they see themselves in the book. So a book is like a mirror, reflecting back on society. In this particular case, yes, are they such characters? My research has confirmed to me that yes. So it is now up to my artistic creative license to portray, to create a character that reflects reality as much as possible, mm-hmm. as closely as possible. But yes, those characters exist in real life.
This is at the point that I would actually invite Cap Akirok to read a poem from the middle of the book. Which one had you chosen? There's one that you had actually chosen. Are you reading one from the bishop or from Dikedi? The poems, the one that you had picked from page 91.
Oh, page 91. Mm. Okay. Yes, this was about love.
Was that Dikedi or Dr. Masala?
This is by Dikedi. Yeah, Dikedi now. Because that's why I'm telling you that as the relationship evolved, she reveals to us through her actions and so on that there is something, there's some warm feeling mm-hmm. that she has for the guy despite what has happened. Anyway, this one is about love. Mm-hmm. You remember she is learning to write poetry. Mm-hmm. This man is supposed to teach her how to write poetry. And so she had done something and she was sharing this one for him to read and critique and so on. So it's titled Love. Some say love is a butterfly that perches gingerly on the heart, ready to fly away at the slightest sneeze. Others say it's a restless nomad, roaming and roving from heart to heart, leaving a trail of footprints and whispered pains. Still others say it's a sojourner, a guest in the lodging of our heart, a passerby ready to leave at the crack of dawn. I disagree. Though love may come as an invited guest, if a nest it finds in our heart, it stays put. Careful then, make no nest carelessly in your heart.
So you are now going to read the last one?
Let me read the last poem now, which is really containing his reflection on everything that has happened to now. And it's a letter from Dr. Masala Sala. Mm-hmm. It says, I, Masala Sala, an epistle to the Lord. Dear Lord, here I am. I, present in flesh, blood, and spirit, lodged in human minds as a kindred sensation, a fleeting disturbance of the air, a persistent sound and silence, a fleck of flesh in an endless universe, now enveloped in a cloud of swirling thoughts. And so I, Masala Sala, here I am, dear Lord, stripped of my religious robes, but not robbed of my identity, challenged by my conscience, but conscious of my madness, lost in a self-created mess, but amazed that I breathe still, a butterfly darting about, haphazard, but hazarding everything on a wing. I, Masala Sala, here I am, dear Lord, here I am, in a foreign land now, I and my two destinies, in the land of the Paswana, training my ear and tongue in Seswana, staring at ancient rocks for answers, but only seeing questions. What, God, is life's quest? Is it to see and not see? To feel and not feel? To think and not think? Is it a vessel to convey motion, especially motion in emotion? A tool to transmit consciousness across space and time? Dear Lord, when my emotional motion aligned with our emotional energy, consider the resulting stardust from the starburst. Were we not vessels of creation, of transmission of consciousness, bearers of human mystery, of the destiny of human consciousness? If so, dear Lord, I bear my cross. I don't bear it lightly, but I bear it still. You are sincerely Masala Sal.
You know, Cap Akirok there is a thinker. He's a poet. He's actually offered us a novel, A Dusk in the Morning, but you can see he's a poet. I would actually invite the listeners of the Books Cafe to look for this book, which was launched
on the 15th of May.
Yes, it's available in our bookshops. This is a sister who has actually gotten pregnant and she's in a convent. What happens to her? These are the things that I want you to discover. Does she keep that pregnancy? Does she abort, which is not allowed in the Catholic Church? And nuns are not allowed to carry babies. What happens? How does she overcome these challenges? Those are the questions that you will see the way the writer, Cap Kirok, actually looks at these issues, and the girl goes through the motion, and the story is very powerful. I called it a very powerful and realistic story. It is a timeless story about these two people, the bishop and the nun, and the other characters in the book. Cap, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Your last words, in general.
In general, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I urge listeners to buy it and read it. I think it will stimulate some discussion, a much-needed discussion, and I think that the church will be stronger for it. Thank you.
I was your host, Hainga Okwemba, and the producer of the program was Jared Ombui. Until next time, it's goodbye for now.